This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Yeah, I will say I've been like telling myself, like, if something happens this week, at least they didn't mess up Best Picture.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the Faye Dunaway of Education Reform, Alyssa Schrank.
Hey, Mike.
How are you?
I'm good. Did you watch the Oscars this weekend?
I did not make it long enough to see that big snafu at the end, and I cannot make myself watch it. It sounds so terrifying. But before we get into that, let me also welcome our special other co-host and guest, Anne Highslip, the Senior Associate for Policy and Advocacy at Chiefs for Change.
Thanks, Mike and Faye.
Yeah.
Great to be here.
You can be the Warren Beatty of Ed Reform.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Not sure I want to play that role.
Oh, I had not even thought of that.
So Faye Dunaway. Now, was it her fault?
It was her fault.
Really?
It was really
Didn't
her fault.
Did they hand her the wrong envelope?
So there were a lot of people at fault. And I've been fascinated by this because it's a train wreck. Someone handed her Warren Beatty and Hyslop the wrong envelope. He looked at it and he was really confused because it didn't have, said, I think, like Emma Stone.
Yeah.
And then he handed it to Faye Dunaway, who saw that it said La La Land.
Yeah.
And she said La La Land.
Gotcha.
Awkward.
He was an enabler.
Have you guys ever made as big a mistake as this one? What do you think? In your policy wonkery, press releasery? No? I mean,
I hope not.
I really hope not.
Pretty big one.
I will say I've been like telling myself, like, if something happens this week, at least they didn't mess up Best Picture.
And not in front of millions of people.
Exactly. Yeah, like 33 million people.
Millions of people.
Amazing. Well, hey, Anne, we're super excited to have you. Anne, until recently, was in the Obama administration. What was your title? Did you have one of those crazy titles like I had?
I was a senior policy advisor in the Office of Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Development.
Yeah.
Very
long.
Yeah. The business cards over there, the department, have to be very large in order to fit people's
faces. Very large and very small font.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, well, we've got lots to talk about, and Anne has particular expertise on what we're talking about today, so we're super excited. Let's play Ed Reform Update. All right, Anne, you wrote a great piece, perhaps the wonkiest piece I've seen on any blog in years.
That's saying something.
For our flypaper blog last week, it was entitled, what was it, Alyssa?
It was 40 ESSA Rules Endangered by Republicans' Repeal Efforts.
40. Now, let's go backwards a little bit here. I did reach out to you, Anne, asking if you'd be willing to help people understand specifically what's in the ESSA regs that's at stake. Because as we know, Congress is thinking about repealing the Obama administration accountability regs. They can do this with this thing called the Congressional Review Act. They can do it on a majority vote. It is filibuster proof. And I had the sense that people were talking about this in generalities. It would be helpful to have some specifics. So I asked if Anne could provide a few examples of of provisions, and you came up with 40.
40. It's a nice round number, and I held back.
It was just her initial 40.
I think your draft said, you know, to be clear, this is not an exhaustive list. I love it.
It was a long reg. There's a lot in there.
And you helped to craft these. Is that fair to say? I'm sure were in those endless meetings that happen over there.
There were many meetings. I read many thousands of public comments, and in particular, the accountability section is probably what I know best, but there's also a lot in the rules around data reporting and just the process that states have to go through if they want to submit this consolidated plan.
All right. So there is a debate going on right now about whether Congress should do this, should actually repeal these regs. House has already acted. It's now up to the Senate. Of course, keep in mind, as we know from that Betsy DeVos process, there are 52 Republicans. So, you know, you lose three Republicans if the Democrats stay united on this and oppose repealing the regs. It wouldn't happen. And I would argue that that would be actually a good thing. I'll get to that a little bit later. I think that we should let Betsy DeVos get rid of the regs that are wrongheaded, of which I think there are some, Anne, let's be clear. But let's start, first of all, you have two lists. And your first list of 20 regs, you say, are things that actually give more flexibility to the states than the law itself does. Explain, because when people hear regulation, I think they usually think that means restriction.
Yeah, I think that that's the common understanding of what rules are. But, you know, ESSA is a complicated law. And I think that they worked really hard to get to a bipartisan solution. And that meant, in many cases, being vaguer than mm-hmm. either side mm-hmm. would have liked to have been.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of places where, you know, the law lays out some basic premise of what should be an accountability system, but doesn't get into the details, you know, the actual questions mm-hmm. about implementation that states have of, can we average data? Mm-hmm. You know, you say over 3 years, but could we average that? You, mm-hmm. when you say proficiency, what does that mean? Does that mean the proficient level? Does that mean advanced scores, as yep. you yep. And your Fordham colleagues argued? There are a lot of those sorts of pieces where rules are needed to flesh out what is possible. And I think that that's part of what we tried to do when we got really good mm-hmm. ideas from different people commenting and suggestions. We knew what states were doing under NCLB. Mm-hmm. We knew what they were doing under the waiver system yep. and trying to write in some of those flexibilities into the law.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, makes it really crystal clear for states who are often cautious when things are ambiguous. No, please don't be cautious in this mm-hmm. case. This is absolutely 100% okay for you to do.
So let's talk about this, because playing devil's advocate, other folks, I've talked to some Republican aides in the Senate, for example, who say, hey, if it's not explicitly not allowed by the law, then it's allowed. And so you don't need this permission in the regs. The states can just do it. So, for example, this issue we care a lot about, allowing these an achievement index to measure academic achievement, right? So not just measuring achievement at the proficiency level. The law says something like, the language is academic achievement, you know, measuring proficiency. I mean, it has the word proficiency in there. It mentions academic achievement. It's not clear, but I guess they would say, well, it doesn't prohibit an achievement index, so it's fine. What's wrong with that approach?
I think that then you're relying on, I think what that leads to is states coming sort of one by one to the department saying, is this okay?
Yeah.
I think mm-hmm. the rule,
mother may I?
It's a little bit more mother may I. You could say a rule and, or, you know, I think you could also say you could do this through guidance as well. That's another tool the department has. But it's mm-hmm. when the department proactively comes out and says, this is okay. I think that those states, even mm-hmm. those that, you know, may not have thought to ask, actually can see it as an opportunity mm-hmm. of something they can do. And it's something that is harder to change.
Yeah.
You know, I think that that is where if it was done sort of on an ad hoc basis by one state to coming to the department with that plan or through guidance, that's more easily changed in the future. Mm-hmm. A rule is, you know, the strongest tool the department has, but it's also in many ways the most permanent, because in order to change yeah. it, you have to go through public comment process and get mm-hmm. feedback on right. how to do that.
Right.
I think, and coming as the person at the table with the least amount of expertise in ESSA, something that strikes me is that a lot of this boils down to what capacity do we think that folks on the state level have and what kind of guardrails do they need to be most effective? And my kind of argument is this is like bowling. Like, you need a couple guardrails, but you don't need huge guardrails. And so it's like striking that balance between like what makes things clearer versus what makes things restrictive.
Yeah. And again, I think it's important to delineate between areas where there's more flexibility being given versus those regs where they are legitimately taking some flexibility away. One last point on the flexibility piece. There's one in there that you mentioned that is says, for example, you can get school improvement money even if you're not a Title I school. And I assume that is not in the law. But the issue is lots of high schools, for example, are not Title I schools, but plenty of high schools you would want to be able to spend school improvement money on to turn around. And so if that regulation is not there, then states will not feel comfortable sending money to high schools because they worry that an auditor might come along and declare that that was an illegal use of funds.
Right. I mean, I think that's a perfect example. That was probably the number one question we got from states in a meeting about a month after the reg came out, where, you know, we said it one time and that wasn't enough. You had to say it 10 yeah. times. Yes, these yeah. funds can go to high schools that have been identified.
Yeah.
They don't become Title I schools, but, you know, we yeah. recognize these are low grad rate high schools and need the support. And that's what makes sense. Yeah. The school improvement mm-hmm. funds
yeah.
should
and,
go
and,
there.
And these local, here's what people got to understand. These state and local officials have learned from experience. Look, Ann Hyslop can tell them whatever they want. Or even Betsy DeVos can tell yeah. them whatever they want in guidance. That is just a recommendation. All right. The Office for the Inspector General pays no attention to that. All they care about, all the auditors care about, is what is in the law or in the regulation. And if it's not there, they're going to have their own interpretation. All right. And now I have to say, you then have your list of 20 provisions that do restrict state action. And I got to say, for most of them, I think they should go away. I mean, I don't see the argument for keeping these regs, which I think we should do on a case-by-case basis, but I think most of them, but what do you think? What's the argument for some of these things that do restrict state authority?
So I think what I tried to do in this post, I think, is actually to focus on the things that didn't get a whole lot of attention during the debate. I think there were certain pieces of the rules that got an outsized amount of pushback.
Supplement.
Well, that's not part of this rule, but yeah, I mean, I think that was one. Summative ratings, part rate, weighting of indicators. You know, those were the pieces that people, many people understand sort of what the debate was and where it landed. There are other parts of the rule, though, particularly, and this is where I think around the transparency and reporting provisions, where it does make sense for some things to be uniform.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I point out is that the statute actually doesn't require parents to know if their child attends a low-performing school. That's not in the statute. Right. We had to regulate to make that so. And if, you know, particularly if you're a school choice advocate, that's like a linchpin of school choice, is to make sure that parents are informed with the information they need to make a choice for their child.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are some, like there's this reg that you guys put in there that said, you know, states have to publish these ratings before the beginning of the school year, which, again, you know, that'd be great. In an ideal world, we'd love to know which schools are A, B, C, D, or F before the beginning of the school year, right? But it's kind of hard to do that turnaround in time.
The report cards need to be published by the end of the year. So it wasn't, the report cards were actually December. The beginning of the school year piece was really aimed more at notifying districts and schools of what their status was so that if they were identified, you don't, you know, necessarily lose a whole academic year before you can actually start planning. A lot of that planning time happens in the summer. So it was to try and nudge, I think, as much as possible.
But the unintended consequence could be that people would feel like, oh, now we got to really do testing in January instead of in May because we can't get the results back in time. And so then that's going to, you know, create this problem that, you know, a lot of people think, hey, we want to have the test as late in the year as possible so we can cover as much of the material. Mm-hmm. So that would be an example, in my view, of the federal government overreaching, that there's legitimate trade-offs.
Yes.
All right. And here's the thing. So if you're Betsy DeVos and you look at these regs and like to say, you just look at your 40 examples and 20 of them are things that she'd say, hey, they actually give more state flexibility. I'd like to keep those. And the other 20 tie states hand and I'd like to kill those. Right. If the Congressional Review Act thing goes through, does she have that option?
No.
No.
Because it has to be substantially different, right?
Because it's basically repeal without replace.
Okay.
It says the department cannot replace these regs with anything substantially similar. So if you want to do a more case-by-case approach, or even if you want to kill most of the regs, but just keep a handful, then what Congress is about to do is going to mess up that plan. Mm-hmm. If Congress takes a pass, let's say we're able to convince some moderate Republicans in the Senate not to go down this road. What is the process Betsy DeVos could use if she wants to get rid of some but not all of the regs?
So I think that there sort of is a short-term play and a long-term play.
Okay.
In the short term, the easiest thing you can do is to issue some guidance very quickly, you know, through Dear Colleague letters. You know, those don't require a whole lot of review. Yep. To just clarify, here are some places as we review state plans where we've taken a different interpretation than the previous administration did.
Yeah.
So that
this is called non-enforcement, right? We are not going to enforce these regulations.
To be, I think it makes it sends a pretty strong signal to states that, you know, here are some aspects of the rules that we just have a different take on them.
Yeah.
And that would be some immediate relief. And then in the long term, because regulating is a longer process, the department could issue a draft notice of rules to change or repeal parts of the rule. And it would be a much more targeted approach. Mm-hmm. The CRA is a very blunt tool. It's like taking a wrecking ball to the whole thing. This would more be chiseling away at certain pieces. And they could also add things that we didn't think to regulate on, tie in different pieces. And, you know, it would go through public comments. So the public, again, would have a chance to weigh in on the process. It'd be a much more transparent way of rerouting or perhaps reorienting what the ESSA plan should look like. But I think, you know, it's not an immediate process, but this is the way that government works. And it would be the standard process as opposed to this CRA, which is unprecedented. And, you know, we don't know all the full implications of it.
You're working with Chief Surchange now. What sort of messaging or what are you hearing from states or telling to states about like how to approach ESSA implementation, like in the short term as we figure everything out, as we learn whether or not the CRA is going to happen?
Yeah, it's a really tough time. I think in particular, we have 6 state chief members. We also have district LEA superintendents that we work with, but for our states, 5 of the 6 of them are planning to submit in April. Yeah. So for them, this is an immediate problem of, is this template going to change? We've already gone through multiple drafts, multiple rounds of stakeholder engagement. It's at our governor's office right now for consultation. And any changes to the template at this point could be really problematic for them, just from a mechanical standpoint of how do we keep the content that we wanted in, that we believe in is the right thing to do. And then moreover, it's causing some questions, I think, about whether this, you know, means we should delay the submission of our plan, even though we were committed to coming in early and wanted to get the ball rolling in the 17-18 school year. And so they're having to fight some pushback at the grassroots level around explaining, no, this is why it's important for us to move forward and stick to our guns on what we believe is the right thing to do.
All right. Awesome stuff. Thank you, Anne Hyslop, for joining us from Chiefs for Change. Folks out there, come on, let's jam the Senate switchboard. Just like folks did during the DeVos thing. Where are all those angry protesters? Save the regs. Save the regs.
Please call.
Please call. Thank you, Anne. All right. That's all the time we got for Ed Reform Update. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Joining us this week is Fordham's David Griffith. Hello, David.
Hi, Mike. How's it going?
I'm well. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You happy about Moonlight or La La Land? Or do you think they should like each get, should it be a tie? How should
Moonlight
they do this?
Won just because they accidentally announced the wrong winner. Like Moonlight still won and it's a great movie.
I was happy with the ultimate result.
Yeah.
I think it was just.
Yes. Okay. There we go. Alyssa's just bitter because she never liked La La Land.
Now I'm actually mad because everyone else is hating La La Land. And I'm like, I hated this first.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good movie. I think it's wildly misunderstood and overhyped. That's all.
Okay. There we go. All right. So speaking of overhyped and misunderstood.
And La La Land.
And La La Land. We're talking about Peer Effects.
Yeah.
All right. Here we go. So today's study is by Tom Ahn and Justin Trogdon, and it was released through the Brookings Institute. And it is titled Peer Delinquency and Student Achievement in Middle School. And I'm excited about it because I think it's really cool. Basically, what they did was they looked at middle school students in North Carolina in like 2010 to 2012. Mm-hmm. And they used a classic researcher's strategy called
an
instrumental variables approach, Alyssa, which I'm not going to get too far into here, except to say that essentially what they did was they looked at fifth graders and they looked at the peers of delinquent fifth graders on the theory that some of the delinquency rubbed off on them, right? And then they looked at those same fifth graders in sixth grade and tried to see if that delinquency in sixth grade rubbed off on their peers. In other words, so it's a strategy that's trying to get around, you know, like selection effects, right? And get at the real cause here. And I don't think there's any need to get further into that. But basically, what they found was that there was an effect. So that some of this delinquency was carried over from one grade to the next. And they used this to estimate the effects of being around, quote unquote, delinquent peers in general. These are peers who were suspended. Yeah, Alyssa, okay. You have a question.
Yes. Sorry, I had that face on. Yes. So when we say delinquent, do we mean defined as, you know, they did something and the courts got involved, or is this like potentially variable by school's discipline codes?
Yes, it's potentially variable, but serious enough to get to warrant an out-of-school suspension. Okay. So effectively, the delinquent peers, they call them the peers who had more than 2 out-of-school suspensions a year, which is a lot, actually, if you're suspended 3 times, right? And sort of they assume that these kids are, I guess, the source of the problem, right? And that the other kids are the ones who are being impacted by it.
Except during the suspensions.
Right. That's true. Okay. Yeah. So it's not a study of suspensions, right? So it's a study of what misbehavior.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's important. So
yeah. And the whole peer effects thing is interesting because, you know, of course, we've forever looked at the impact of teachers and, you know, whether that varies. But, you know, you got to also pay attention that the theory is it does matter who's in class with you.
Right. Okay, so let me just get to the bottom line and then we can start arguing.
Sorry, we do this.
No, that's okay. So basically what they found was that about a 10% increase in delinquent peers is associated with about a 0.06 standard deviation decrease in math scores. So for perspective, that's about half the achievement gains that you might expect if you cut class sizes in half. So it's a significant effect. It's not an overwhelming effect.
Okay.
So I think this is deeply intuitive, right? You know, we all, any former teacher knows, basically, right, that misbehaving kids, they do. They have a cost on their peers. And and we're getting closer to quantifying it, I think.
Yep. Okay.
Right. Now, keep in mind that it's not like an out-of-school suspension is standard. I mean, the argument would be, well, there's some schools that are quicker to suspend kids than others, especially, yes. I mean, maybe not back then. Now there's this big debate about changing discipline rates. Mm-hmm. And so
yeah,
it would be hard to figure out is it really the same kind of misbehavior across schools, or is it that some schools are just quicker to pull the trigger than others?
Yeah. I mean, I think that they acknowledge that in the paper, that it's really, you know, they are lumping together things that are not necessarily the same.
Yeah.
But what I do think they're able to do in this paper is account for the notion of selection and show that, in fact, yes, you know, being in class with these kids has a cost, which does not answer the question of what to do with them.
I mean, it's similar to, as I think about as a manager here at Fordham, you know, the productivity of employees. And would that be impacted by having certain people in the office next to them who might decrease their productivity? And how could we?
I don't know why people are looking at me.
I'm just teasing. Alyssa at times has been known to perhaps be someone who you know, likes to chat with her colleagues, which is a collegial thing to do until it reduces productivity.
I am a communicator. Some people are researchers.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, I think where the authors come down is they say, you know, they essentially say we should address delinquency directly, which I don't know what that means. But, you know, they essentially say, like, look, there's lots of different ways we, you know, we can try to help kids, class size reduction, tracking, et cetera. But their point is we should, you know, like we should. And this is where I come down to. And you know, we keep dancing around the issue, right, which is that the kids need help. Right. And I don't know where they get that help, inside or outside. But, you know, I think we just, at some level, we have to acknowledge what's going on and tackle it directly.
Right. In other words, we may need alternative school settings for some of the kids if they're, you know, chronic disruptors.
Alternative or alternative classroom settings within the school. But, I mean, I think for me, what frustrates me is I feel like, honestly, both sides of the suspensions debate or the discipline debate, call it what you want, but, like, you know, there's this tendency to dance around, like, actually addressing the problem itself, you know, through something like restorative justice, which treats it as totally like a community issue. Like these kids don't have, like, it isn't the kids who really have problems, right? Or trying to, you know, I mean, I this is my criticism of suspensions, right? Is that it's like, you're not, you know, it does solve the problem for the school, but it doesn't really solve the problem for the kids. So, I don't know. The debate is going to continue, I guess, is the bottom line. But I think that in terms of our own moral calculus, I think being able to put some numbers on it is helpful. So maybe that's the big takeaway here.
Yep. And to remind ourselves, oftentimes these debates get simplified. How could you possibly be in favor of suspending kids when we know it's so bad on those kids? And, you know, my response is usually, well, I hear that and I worry about that. But it, you know, having disruptive kids in class is also bad on the peers. And so let's acknowledge the complexity here. And no, we don't want a system where we end up saying, well, for the greater good, we're going to just totally screw over a group of kids and, you know, put them in a box somewhere and forget about them. I mean, but how can we come up with solutions that are both good for these kids who are showing disruptive behavior and good for their classmates? Mm-hmm. And you know, right now it doesn't feel like we have that kind of a nuanced conversation very often.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it is, you know, always important. The researchers worry about this. We need to worry about too, that when we're talking about things like teacher quality, that we can't forget that, you know, you got to pay attention to the composition of classes. Mm-hmm. And again, any teacher would know that, right? If some teachers systematically get harder classes every year than other teachers, if they get all the tough kids in the same classroom, that's going to have an impact.
Yeah. And as a teacher, you feel like classes have like a tenor or a mood and you kind of remember them by like what happened in that class.
All right. Thank you, David, for pinch hitting here on the Research Minute.
Doing our best.
That is all the time we've got. Until next week.
I'm Alyssa Schwenk.
And Alyssa's peer, Mike Petrilli, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.